The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Steve O'Timothy is with me in studio now. He is a comedian, but he is also a campaigner, long-time campaigner, when it comes to road safety. And this on the day that the Road Safety Authority actually are before an Oireachtas committee answering questions about campaigns that they run to improve safety on our roads against the backdrop of an increase in road deaths last year and people worrying that we're looking at a similar increase this year. Steve, you're welcome to studio and thanks a million for making your way to us from Galway today. For people who don't know your story, maybe we will start there in 2005. So tell us what happened.
Yeah, in 2005, I made the worst decision of my life. I decided to drink drive on my bike. I was celebrating. I went back to do my leaving cert as a mature student. And I went back and it was the last exam that evening, as I'd done back in them days, get drunk, celebrate it. So I ran out of drink. I decided it would be a great idea at the time to drive the bike into town and get more drink. So yeah, it didn't end that way.
You weren't alone.
No, I had John Laffey on the back, a friend of mine. Didn't have him first. I met him in town and then after that, then we crashed on the east side of the city. I don't remember the crash. I don't remember much about it. Just remember waking up and, yeah, in extreme pain and just, yeah, it wasn't easy.
When do your memories start to reform? Is it like on the road post-crash? Is it in the hospital? How soon afterwards can you remember?
Kind of in the hospital, really. Like the next few days, people were like ringing me and things started coming back. But I knew I made a balls of my life. I knew that instantaneously, even in the book of evidence. I was in court for it, charged, and the book of evidence said that he admitted it on scene. So I even knew that morning when I was lying paralysed that I just said, yeah, it was me driving, I did it. So I knew I'd made a balls of everything.
And we'll talk about John in a moment, but what impact did it have on you? So you're here in a wheelchair in studio.
Yeah, I use a wheelchair or crutches. I can stand or walk for short distances. So, yeah, I broke two bones in my neck and seven or eight in my back, T4 to T10 inclusive, I think. And then my leg and shoulder, collarbones, all that kind of, the minor ones. But it was the spinal injury, T4. So it was upper, about the nipple line down that I had no movement or no sensation from. So still limited sensation, limited movement. So I got a bit back.
John didn't survive the crash.
No, about a week and a half later, John died, but that was kept from me. So no one told me. It was kind of, I suppose, to protect me. And I suppose that was obviously the hardest point of the whole thing. I was up in the rehab hospital in Dunleary and the physio was starting to go good and I started getting movement back in my second toe on my right foot. I still remember it to this day. And I was out pushing myself and always like trying to steal crutches out of the gym to like try it myself out in the car park. Nearly got expelled from a hospital, however you do that. But yeah, I think it was about a month and a half then into it, the psychologist came in to talk to me and she was just like, your dad is going to be ringing you at 2 o'clock. And I was like, that's strange. What, like my dad had just ring me. You know what I mean? The awful is like that, you know. And then the nurse came over and said, don't forget your dad is ringing at 2. So I knew then something was up. And like looking back, I don't know how I can cop it. Like they said, he had damaged his legs, but he was up in Beaumont. And I never put two and two together that you wouldn't be in Beaumont for broken legs. But I suppose it was my dad's way of protecting me. But yeah, he rang and he just goes, Stephen. And I said, yeah. And he goes, I have something to tell you. And I said, John's dead. And he said, how did you know? Who told you? And I said, no one. I just know by the way you're talking. And he goes, what are you going to do? And I just said, nothing. I just hung up and asked them to get the hoist, took me out of the hospital bed in my wheelchair, went downstairs into the kind of where the day room was, but it was late evening, obviously, and I locked myself in a bathroom and listened to music and smoked fags for the night. And that was, I always say it's you're in an awful strange situation when even the option of suicide is taken from you by yourself, because I know it sounds weird, but when you're in that situation, it's a comfort to know that I can leave at any time. I have that power. I have the power over my life to basically go. But when even that is taken from you because you're paralysed, you can't get out of the hospital. You can't climb out a window. So you're literally trapped. Even the option of suicide, I took that from myself. even that. And I know it would have been a coward's way out and everyone would say, yeah, yeah. Mm. But you didn't kill your friend in a drink driving accident. So,
is that what your dad was getting at when he asked, what are you going to do?
I don't know. I always look back and lots of interviews and things. I always think of my dad having to make that phone call because he knew my mental state and he knew how I'd be. And he possibly had in his head, I'm ringing possibly and giving my son news that will end up with him taking his life and I have to give him that news. So I always kind of tried to give a bit of credence and give a bit of like how tough that was for him to do and that I put him in that situation. It wasn't only destroying my life physically, mentally, John's life, John's family, but my dad and my family. Like my dad had Parkinson's, my mother had dementia, there was learning disabled Jamie and he has a learning disability, and then Ronan, my little brother, was only 8. And here's absolute twat coming home in a wheelchair. Here mind me now as well. You know, so it's, yeah.
And talk to me then about the weeks or months afterwards. I mean, what did you imagine for your future? Or, you know, what were you thinking? Were you just thinking about kind of things on a day-by-day basis? Were you imagining what you would do now with all of this?
You couldn't really think about the future much because that was gone. You had no future. It was really day-to-day. It was just get through this physio, go out the back, smoke a few fags the next day, try and get out of the hospital, I suppose. And that was my big goal, to get out of the hospital. Because I kind of knew at that stage, because my dad had went to John's funeral and met the family and they weren't angry at me. And even to this day, John's son Thomas does be saying to me, like, why you stop blaming yourself? You were drinking. He jumped on the bike. You know, stop. And I'd be all like,
that immediate with them?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there was never any anger or animosity. They were like, you were two friends that were drinking together. And it was kind of, you know.
How did you react to that? Because some people, and some people want people to be angry with them.
Yeah, I didn't.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I kind of didn't feel right. And it's like what I said earlier when I was in court and the judge gave me a suspended sentence and people were coming over, well done and stuff. And I was like, well done for what?
Yeah, you want to be punished. Yeah. You want people to be angry with you to kind of validate how low you feel about yourself.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, as a motorcyclist, you're responsible for your pillion passenger. And I failed in that responsibility.
Mm.
So you want to, but the judge said, look, you're paying a, you know, by your very physically when people look at you and see you. So, yeah. So, but like I said, I never crib about my condition. I give out, I suppose if I'm giving out to me, I'm angry at me for stealing that 23-year-old Stephen's future. You know, that kind of way. I ruined his life. I always see it as kind of distancing.
And is that how you think about your own life now in totality, is kind of two lives, kind of what kind of...
Oh yeah, if I'm talking to my girlfriend or brother, it's like before the crash. And sometimes I'd find myself going, oh, I could climb that wall. And then I go, I went from cycling and climbing mountains, cycling out to Clifton from Galway and climbing mountains to being afraid of a wet leaf on a footpath or afraid to stand up. You know what I mean? And I get bad spasms as well, which cause me to fall quite regularly. And it's kind of an everyday thing. But like I said, that's my penance. That's my, like, I'm alive. So I can't complain too much. You know?
And is that how you deal with the guilt then? By telling yourself that, like, this is my penance?
Yeah, it's kind of, well, I suppose what I'm doing now is more kind of got to do with a kind of a, I don't know if it's my own search for like self-redemption, because a lot of people in my category as the culprit in the drink driving accident, not the victim and culprit, a victim of myself, but I'm not calling myself a victim, don't get me wrong. But yeah, we hide away because of the very nature of the incident. You hide away, and I did that, and I was ashamed. And like when I started doing the comedy and stuff, if anyone was waiting to get a selfie or waiting to talk to me outside the car, I wouldn't leave the car. Because if I left the car, it meant getting the wheelchair, getting the crutches. And if you left the car, getting the wheelchair, the crutches, that brings on questions. Questions lead to, might have to explain what happened, leads to more questions. So I hid it. I hid the crutches in the sketches because I was ashamed of my past. And then I was thinking, if I'm silent about it, if I don't be outspoken about it and show it from the idiot's point of view, the fellow that actually took the drink and done it, then I'm not serving any purpose in my life. I'm not warning anyone, like, firsthand.
Yeah.
So I suppose that's why I'm doing this now. And yeah, you get a lot of like death threats and things for it, and a lot of like stuff said to you. But like, you know,
is stuff still said to you?
Yeah, I get a lot of people that won't forgive me for it, yeah, which I find really strange. They're really, really angry. And I'd be like...
People who knew John and knew you?
No,
just strangers?
No, just strangers. Like people that might be in England. Like, and it'd be... And it wouldn't be like a comment. It'd be a comment, a message, a Twitter message, an email, essays like about how much... Basically to go and kill myself. That, yeah, you know, that's the right thing to do. A life for a life. So, but what purpose would I be serving then? What legacy would I leave? Would I change anyone's mind? You know, it's kind of, I get the anger, but like I always say, it was the Laffey family to forgive. It's not a stranger on the internet to, yeah, forgive me. You know, and what I find is so strange, and I still find it so strange and odd saying it. Sometimes I'd be getting like people like that, whatever, telling me to kill myself or whatever on Facebook. And John's wife and son would be in the common stream defending me. And I feel that even strange, and I get emotional thinking about it because they're there defending me against,
yeah,
strangers that are angry at me over the incident that involved them. And it's strange, and it's refreshing, and it just shows them for who they are.
It's kind of a debt in a way that, I mean, you can never really repay it, that they offered you that forgiveness so quickly and that they defend you as well, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, you can't. Like, there's nothing I could do, even doing all this. And even, you know, like you say, it's hard to quantify a negative. So you don't know if you've actually made a difference. You don't know if a lad at home didn't go drink driving,
yeah, because
it's not an incident then to record. But you hope that you might do that. And you hope that in speaking in a certain way and speaking as a little gombean I was at that age, that maybe I'll reach the little gombeans that are around now that might be thinking of doing it. So like I always say when I'm in an interview, I didn't do it today, but I'll always ask for one curse, because I find it just gets the message across a bit more. Instead of like, I messed up my life. Drink driving made me fuck up my life.
And who are the target audience? Is it those young men? Is that primarily who you're speaking,
yeah,
to?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
How old were you in 2005?
23.
23. Yeah. So you're exactly in that cohort.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting. I mentioned the RSA. So they were talking today about, and there's people who've been critical of them, but, you know, they talked about the fact they don't run these shocking ads anymore.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they said the reason is because actually that their target audience, like yours, young men primarily.
Yeah.
And young men are just inured to that type of thing. First of all, they're not watching ads. You know, yeah, they're flicking through it.
Or they're not watching TV anyway.
And yeah, and it's kind of, they're so used to seeing violence, video games or online or whatever it happens to be, that it doesn't
immune
have an impact.
It.
And it's hard to know what,
yeah,
will have an impact.
Yeah, people
particularly with
ask,
drugs as well.
Yeah, drug driving is the big one, I know, as well. And
yeah,
because like, young fellas, it's not like, in my day it was a bit of hash, a bit of drink. Nowadays it's everything from Xanax to Lyrica. That's the new big and, you know, and it's like I would say, you'd have the winning lotto number if you knew what to do to try and impact it or, yeah, to reduce it. It's really hard. And like, I'd be on the news every day and I'd be scrolling through. Even before I came here, there was a motorcyclist killed and a woman killed passerby. So that's two. And there'd be two or three, four of them every day.
And I think a cyclist as well was killed in Dunleary, a truck.
Yeah.
Like, just before you came into studio, I got an alert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, it's real. I like, when I was doing the talk in Mayo, like I said, we always use these, you know, we Irish tend to soften words. We always do it like S-H-I-T for S-H, you know,
yeah,
you know, we soften words. But when we're talking about that a lot, we, you know, we'd say passed on or deceased. Like this is death. This is finality. This,
yeah,
is beheadings. This is crushed skulls. This is real stuff. This,
yeah,
is very, very, like an accident isn't forgiving to you. Like a car hitting another car is not, it's not going to, like you will be, you can be ripped in half. Like this is real,
yeah,
horrible, brutal stuff.
And is it that, I've mentioned it on this show before, only briefly, because I, it's not something I like to talk about, because the woman, I don't want to identify her, people to know who, that I was the first person there, but I did come across like that, a woman on a bicycle hit by a truck. And it's exactly as you describe.
Yeah.
Like it's crushed skulls and, yeah, it's gruesome.
And it's impactful even for witnesses.
And Is that a reality you think escapes maybe a lot of young people?
Yeah, because we have a positivity bias.
Yeah.
Like, young lads know.
Which is understandable. That's a human nature thing.
Oh, well, you have to have that. You wouldn't have the confidence to drive if you didn't have that.
Yeah.
With
all due respect, you wouldn't be here if we didn't have a positivity bias.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. Yeah. We have to have that, because if the crushing reality and finality of death and life was in our faces every day, we wouldn't be able to cope. So we have to ignore certain things. But yeah, the positivity bias, because young lads know what can happen. They've been confronted with it. They know a person who's died or a person's cousin who's been in a bad accident. But it's the whole thing but I'm a good driver. I'm always alert.
Yeah.
It wouldn't happen to me. You know, that's the thing. And it's very hard to counter that.
So, I mean, what's the message you hope people listening to this take?
Get off your head. Get off your head at home. Get off your head out. Don't bring a car, don't bring a bike, don't even bring a bicycle. You can get off your head safely and do what you want to do, but just don't get behind the wheel or the handlebars.
Well, listen, we appreciate you, Steve, coming into studio.
Thank you.
And having the chat with us. I have to apologise for any language, but I think people will absolutely understand in the context of what we were talking about, and in terms of emphasising how important this issue is. There was mention of suicide as well, so as always, if, you know, people want to talk to anyone, you can text HELP to 51444. You can call the Samaritans 116123 as well. Lots of messages coming in like this one. I met Steve, heard his story for the first time a few weeks ago. Very highly commendable. He accepted what happened and has tried to save lives now. A very brave man. Good man, Steve. So thank you very much for that text, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you
again.
So much.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.